making Jacksonville a more child-friendly city. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you why UNICEF is bringing its initiatives for kids here to the First Coast and how you can be part of it, too. Give us a call right now. What makes a child-friendly city? What does that mean? Ask your questions and join the conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, a special observance tonight in the city, remembering the victims of the Holocaust. Plus, the Spectator's top fix for your weekend, all of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, here's a question. What makes a child-friendly city? Speakers from UNICEF will shine a light on that question as they bring their Child-Friendly Cities initiative here to Jacksonville. It's important, despite being one of the world's wealthiest nations, the U.S. still has a lot of work to do to promote the well-being of our most vulnerable citizens, our children. The U.S. ranks 37 out of 41 industrialized nations in terms of child well-being. And that's certainly true here in Florida as well. So as we talk about what makes a child-friendly city, we have a great group here in studio to explain it. Here with more, Dr. Jeff Goldhagen with UF Health Jax. Good morning.
Good morning.
Gary Bevel is here. He's Children's Ombudsperson at the Children's Home Society. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Ed White Sr., Alexis Evans, also with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're already getting your calls. What are your questions about UNICEF's Child-Friendly Cities Initiative as it comes to Jacksonville? It's 549-2937. Give us a call at 549-2937 or send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and Facebook is open to you as well. All right, Dr. Goldhagen, let's begin with you. UNICEF has worked all over the world to engage local governments in advancing the well-being and rights of children. They're coming to Jacksonville. So what's happening?
Well, first, let us thank you for having us on the show this morning. Well, the Child Friendly Cities Initiative is around 20 years old. It was launched by UNICEF to advance the health and well-being of children by establishing communities that are rights-respecting and consider the dignity and voice of children. Mm-hmm. At this point, there are thousands of them around the world, well over 1,000 among high-income countries. They've transformed the place of children in their communities. They've transformed the definition of child and childhood. And what they seek to do is create an environment that considers the rights of children and reframes the context of how children participate in communities. They've transformed communities all around the world. And what's important is the United States didn't start off as 37th out of 41st. We were much better positioned decades ago. But as these new ideas and a new understanding of children in childhood and the new understanding of the place of children in communities unfolded, the U.S. Did not follow suit, and other communities in other countries did. So in the context of that, as an example, one of the foundations of child-friendly cities is the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Mm-hmm. The U.S. now is the only country in the world that hasn't ratified the convention.
Wow, I don't think people realize that.
Every other country in the world has ratified it, except the United States, which is a statement to a certain extent as to how we in our country value children.
And why not?
Well, there are lots of reasons for that, one of which is practical, and that it's difficult for the U.S. to ratify international conventions just because of how our government is set up. But for the most part, it's because the issue of rights and giving children's rights, there's this perception that if you give children's rights, you take away parental rights, which is completely not true. And we have yet to come to really value children in the way that other communities around the world have. And I'll just say one last thing and let our friends here also speak. When you look historically, whether it's civil rights or voting rights or gay rights or women's rights or tenants' rights or victims' rights, everything that we hold near and dear to us as far as social, the context of communities in our country has a rights-based context to it, except children. And so that is really what we are hoping to do, is launch a child rights and child-friendly cities movement across the country, beginning here in Jacksonville.
It's 549-2937. What are the rights of the child in this country? As we just learned, the U.S. has not signed on to the International Convention on the Rights of the Child. Their civil rights, their economic rights, social and health rights of children. What are your thoughts about this issue as we talk with Gary Bevel, your children's ombudsperson at the Children's Home Society? So you're looking out for children. That's what your title says to me. And here in Jacksonville and in Florida, we certainly have a long way to go when it comes to providing a healthy environment for kids. Mm-hmm. Kids are, they don't have good health outcomes in this city, a lot of them. They're at risk of gun violence. There are a number of areas, their educational aspirations. There are lots of areas where we're not doing a good job with children. What are your hopes for this initiative, this UNICEF initiative coming to town? What are some of the goals that will be set out?
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. I think while we do have a lot of work to do, one of the great things about Jacksonville is there are a lot of things that we are doing well. We're doing a great job, for instance, at Duval County Public Schools of figuring out ways to give children more of a voice. So that might be the District Student Government Association that has members of high school classes all around the city who have a voice and they have a seat at the table at school board meetings with district staff and with support members throughout the community. The one thing that is going to be a benefit to having UNICEF and this group of experts come together next week is helping Jacksonville understand how some of the individual things and individual successes that we do have in the city are connected. It'll give us a common way to talk about that, and it'll highlight the importance of us having a common message about how we talk about children, how we talk about their needs, how we respond to their rights, and how we include them in decision-making in age-appropriate ways throughout the city. So while this may be a new way for people to think about and talk about children, having these experts come in, having these opportunities for this type of an education helps us to think about how do we identify what some of those gaps are and how do we identify our individual roles, whether that's as individuals, whether that's as organizations like Children's Home Society or like the Partnership for Child Health, or whether that's as a community when we think about the village that is needed to take care of our kids. It gives us a framework. It gives us a way to start using the same language. And it gives us a way to say, well, hey, if we know X, Y, and Z group is doing this and we know we still have this gap, well, then there's our
light
bulb.
What's a specific example of that?
Some of the disconnects, perhaps.
What's a specific example of where we're falling short with our children that UNICEF thinks Jacksonville needs to change?
So you alluded to one. So unfortunately, we have some data from our 2017 Youth Risk Behavior Survey that most of our middle schoolers and high schoolers are taking. And so in 2017, we know that 1 in 7 Duval County students were high school students were obese. And fortunately, we have cultural partners like MOSH who are doing exhibits that are teaching us a little bit about health, too. And so that's an area where when I go to Edward H. White, which is one of our community partnership schools, and I get to sit with some of the kids in the cafeteria, they're not eating the lunches. Many of them aren't eating it. Many of them aren't finding it nutritious. We know some of the barriers to that. The district itself is facing resource barriers, and there are things that make it difficult to maybe provide the most nutritious lunches. And then the other thing is, have we made it cool for kids to have nutritious lunches? A lot of kids see a healthy lunch and it's the first time they've seen something like this. And we can't expect them to just kind of lean into that. So what is our communication? What is our, how do we talk about health? How do we make it exciting? And how do we include young people in decisions about how we address health and how we address their well-being? And UNICEF will help us with that.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show right now. What do you think will make this area a more child-friendly place? Alexis Evans, you're a senior at Ed White High School. And so you're almost an adult, right on the edge of between childhood and adulthood. And what are your thoughts about how this city handles issues that are important to kids?
I would say how they handle the issues. Well, first, I think that though the adults are trying to help us, I still think they think with an adult mind. They don't really connect to the children how, or the youth how they should, I would say. But then it's hard because they're still adults. They're trying to help us.
Right.
But I would say they do it in a, they go about it in a adult way, and we may not yet understand how.
What do you think are the most important issues for kids, teenagers, young people in Jacksonville? What's most important to you?
What's most important to me, I would say, is having more opportunities. I feel like they force college onto us, and I feel like they force, oh, you need a job right away. But I feel like things don't happen right away. I feel like it takes time. And I feel like as soon as you turn 18, which is another thing that I kind of have an issue with, is they put an age on us. Like 18, you're supposed to have everything together. You're just an adult right away. But I feel like it's not an age.
Yeah, it can take time. Dr. Goldhagen, how can people be part of UNICEF's big confab here in Jacksonville before we go to callers?
Yeah, well, first, UNICEF isn't coming to Jacksonville to teach us. In a way, UNICEF is coming to learn from us. So at this meeting on Monday and Tuesday, we'll have 120 people from 30 cities around the U.S. and Canada to really learn how to begin to implement the principles and practices of child-friendly cities. Interestingly enough, UNICEF decided to come to Jacksonville because among U.S. cities, we're the furthest along in building child-friendly cities.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So, for instance, we have had a baby-friendly hospital initiative which addresses the rights of infants to have optimal feeding, in particular breastfeeding. We have the first two rights-respecting schools in the country. And Rights Respecting Schools is a UNICEF, global UNICEF initiative. In the UK and England, there are 1,000 Rights Respecting Schools that have transformed schools in their communities. Mm-hmm. We are the first city in the country to have a children's ombudsperson whose particular focus is to advance youth participation and to advance the voices of children. We have a new Center for Children's Rights, which is really focused on juvenile justice issues and the rights of children and youth in the juvenile justice system. So we have a number of rights-respecting initiatives in the city, more so than any other city in the country. And when UNICEF had to identify a place to launch this movement in the United States, they chose Jacksonville. So
how
we should be
that?
Very
proud. So we're
proud.
The first American city to see this coming, this particular initiative?
Yes.
How amazing is that?
And when we started off planning this conference, we thought we would get maybe 5 or 10 cities that would want to come to Jacksonville. Now we have 30. We have 120 people paying their own way, coming here to learn about not only how to move forward with building rights-respecting communities in their own areas, but also what we've done here in Jacksonville. And Gary has been a tremendous addition to our community over the last few years to help build, as an example, the ombudsperson role and responsibility.
Right. A city that has its own ombudsperson for kids, that is pretty impressive. And it's also amazing to hear that this is the first U.S. city to host this type of global initiative, and it's all about the rights and protection of children. What are your thoughts about UNICEF's Child Friendly Cities Initiative coming to Jacksonville next Monday and Tuesday? More details about how you can attend that in a moment, but first it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Suzanne is on the south side right now. Hi, Suzanne. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hey, go ahead.
Yes, I was calling because I do serve on the city council at Suzanne Jenkins,
And oh, hello. Good to see you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Yeah, I listen to you every morning faithfully. And I'm glad you have this today. When I was on the council, we pushed all the time for children's programming at the parks because we are the largest park system, but yet we don't program it. And we need to start looking at that. We have talked about it for years. We haven't done it. And if we can't do it as a city function, then let's partner with some nonprofits and get these children, especially in the summer, in programs at all our parks for our elementary and middle school students. And then the high school students could be like camp counselors, and then they could have a job and do some mentoring and helping. There's so many opportunities we have for kids to learn about our city and all of the wonderful parks and the different things we have. And that would be such a help to parents who try to figure out, what do I do with my child during the summer when I'm still going to work?
That's Suzanne Jenkins, former Jacksonville City Councilwoman. Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks for that call.
You're welcome.
Okay. Gary Bevel, what about that?
It was great to hear that as an example of really where Jacksonville can take the lead in giving young people the exact opportunities Alexis alluded to. Some of the features of this rights-based approach, and for anyone listening, another way to think about rights is to think about needs. So what are the needs of children? So when we're thinking about that, do they have access to some of those essential social services? Do they live in safe, secure, and clean environments? And do they have some of those opportunities to enjoy family life, life with their friends? The parks are a definite example of that. Jacksonville being one of the largest cities in terms of land in the contiguous U.S., we should definitely be taking advantage of that. And unfortunately, you know, we know stories about kids who haven't been terribly far out of their own neighborhoods, despite having a river, a beautiful beaches, and so many things to take advantage of here in Jacksonville. And when we think about this coordinated approach, where we all start to think about and respond to the needs of children in a more cohesive and comprehensive manner, thinking about how to better utilize our parks and some of our existing services are definitely a part of that. And fortunately, we do have some agencies who care about that and are thinking about that and are including young people in that, like Greenworks, for instance.
That's right. Here's a tweet from Dan. A child-friendly city is one where children of all races have access to quality education, access to medical care, know where their next meal is coming from, and aren't worried about getting shot walking home from school. So, Alexis, basic things like safety, a decent education, enough to eat. There are many, many children in this community who can't count on those basics, you know, which is tragic and unacceptable.
You're absolutely right. And then, unfortunately, that is the case with a lot of kids. And sometimes we feel like we don't really have a choice. That's just the generation we live in now.
What are you, when you think about gun violence in this city, are you worried for yourself or your friends? Is that something that your peer group talks about?
It is, because who wants to live in a city where you have to look over your back and just afraid to walk outside, afraid to go to your local parks? It's like, I kind of feel like it's taking over the city. That's one thing that's we don't have any control of that's really taken away from my childhood. Because if you think about it now, a lot of kids, they used to ride each other's bikes and go to each other's house on bikes or on scooters. And you don't, if you think about it now, they don't really come out with like a lot of bikes anymore. They don't come out with new scooters or new rollerblades because kids are afraid to go outside.
Yeah. Dr. Goldhagen, that to me is so horrible to contemplate, that in this generation of children, they, you know, they just don't feel safe going out on their bikes and playing. And it's really, I know that you have more of the social science around this than I do, but, you know, that's an important part of childhood. Just freedom of movement, being able to play outside without worrying, that's been lost.
Right. And in fact, one of the framework that we use for building child-friendly cities is, in fact, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And so Article 31 of the convention says that children have the right to play and to leisure activity and to cultural activities. So it's not just a need, but it's also a right. Article 12 says that children have a right to participation and to have a voice and to be listened to. And that clearly is a critical need and right for children. Article 16 says that children have a right to be able to come together and associate in an environment that is conducive. So each of the issues that we address in Jacksonville and the challenges we have and also our successes relates back to a particular right. We in this country haven't really defined the fact that children have a right to health. Article 24 says that children have a right to optimal health and health care. Article 27 deals with the right to education. So by framing our work and building a child-friendly cities, we use the Convention on the Rights of the Child to identify what are all the needs of kids. And one of the critical principles is that they're not divisible. They're not independent. In order to provide the optimal health and well-being for children, we have to address all of their needs. And in the framework of a child-friendly city, we have to address all of their rights.
549-2937. Regina is in Mandarin. Hey, Regina, good morning to you. Go ahead, Regina.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to thank Alexis. I think she's well-spoken, and I think she's right on the money. In this discussion of child rights, parenting skills have to come into this. The community, other resources, where if there's absent parents, what other adults are in the community to mentor. So there is, and if there's a pathway not to push to college, you can't let 18-year-olds like a balloon let free at age 18. There has to continue through at least another 4 more years till age 21. Mm-hmm. We can't 20. You know, you can't even drink at age 18. So why is 18? You're an adult. That doesn't work that way. So what? How do we address the fact that when you talk about children's rights, and Alexis is right on the money, how do we get that mentality that, boom, you know, done? Mm-hmm. There's got to be resources that are available for that age group. And if you don't want to go to college, are there vocational schools that need to be supported more in our community? And I'll take my answer off the call. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Regina, for that. You know, Alexis, are you 18 yet, by the way?
No, ma'am.
Not yet, 17?
Yes, ma'am.
But I think that's so important to note that, you know, in generations past, the minute you turned 18, you were regarded as an adult by the world, legally and socially. Legally, you're going to be an adult at age 18. But socially, I think our culture has come around to the idea that kids progress into adulthood in stages, that they don't just automatically become an adult mentally and socially at age 18. They do need more support as they ease into their 20s. And so you are planning to go into the military. Is
correct.
That right?
That's
and
right.
So how do you feel about this transition?
I'm not really scared. I feel like I'm ready because I feel like the military will give me more guidance for the age that I'm going to turn than really this generation would outside. Because I feel like between 18 to 20, that's the most phases that you actually need to be parented on. So I feel like that's when you experience the most.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when you're 18 and you're 19 and you're 20, I feel like they're like, oh, you're an adult. You make your own decisions. But I feel like you need help making those decisions. And I feel like we're so left alone. And I feel like that's the age group where that makes or breaks you as an adult. Because I feel like if you get the help that you need when you're 18, 19, I feel like that could help you and guide you for like the rest of your life. And that's a very vital and essential part to your life.
Yeah, it's,
and you're left
it's a
alone.
Critical time.
It is.
And, you know, it's interesting to look at the science on brain development. Gary Bevel, a young adult's brain is still developing, even into their mid-20s. Even though society labels them as an adult, their brains are still literally forming adult brains, right?
They absolutely are. We're learning that it might be even longer than mid-20s. And I think, Melissa, I'm glad in the conversation with Alexis, this has come up. I think we have to be sensitive to what it means for parents who, for the most part, are some of the most loving and well-meaning people there are. But it doesn't mean that they've been provided with all the information and equipped with all the tools they could possibly have to best raise their young people. And one of the beautiful things about a child-friendly cities approach, or appreciating and implementing the rights, like Dr. Goldhagen was just sharing with us, is included in those rights first, we should know our lot that talk about those very needs of parents, having an adequate standard of living, young people having that right to be in the household with the family of origin, and then the community stepping in to support when that family needs help. So that's a critical part of it. And we have to give parents space to understand that just because they might not have known this information before or have access to it, it doesn't make them bad parents. It doesn't necessarily mean anything's gone wrong. There's just this new opportunity to do things to do things better, including listening to a lot of our young people.
Mariah in Riverside. Hey, Mariah. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say two things. One, I have a 3-year-old and he's just started to get into scootering and riding his bike around our neighborhood. And it is so terrifying for me as a parent because there's not an awareness of bikes and pedestrian safety. So I think that that would really just benefit our community in general. I grew up in Atlantic Beach and had the freedom to ride my bike to school. Because the speed limits are low, people are going slowly, whereas here in Riverside, it's just, you know, pedal to the metal and right. Making it to where you have to go. And then secondly, the only time I feel like I see police officers in our community is when there's, like, truancy officers during high school hours, and I feel like they're, like, these kids are just, like, not set up for success when the police are just running them down in the running them down in the parks, trying to like catch them from skipping school. And it doesn't seem like that is that's not the issue, them skipping school. It's like, why are they skipping school?
Yeah, to begin with. Right. Sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for those points, Mariah. So many elements to this discussion as we're hearing from all of these calls. And so, Dr. Goldhagen, this conference is coming up next Monday and Tuesday at the Hyatt Place at the St. John's Town Center. How can people learn more and be part of this?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, we are oversubscribed.
Oh, so it's that popular.
Yes, it has. And again, it's that popular from not only folks from Jacksonville, but nationally.
Around the world, too.
And the two people that are going to be leading the presentation, one is a woman by the name of Louise Thavant, who's the head, comes from Geneva and is the head of child-friendly cities globally. And the other is a woman by the name of Jerison Lansdowne, who's been here a couple of times, who's among the premier child advocates in the world. So it's not so much what will be happening on Monday and Tuesday, but it will be what happens thereafter as we move this agenda. And let me just comment briefly. So one of the core building blocks of a child-friendly cities is that children have a safe, secure, and clean environment. And when we build our communities and as an example, when we have all the discussion about what's happening downtown, we need to include the voice of children. We need to include their perspectives as to what would create a safe environment for them, and what kind of environment do they want? And even three-year-olds, hearing the voices of three-year-olds is an important part of what we do. So hearing the voice, engaging children and youth in decision-making. I haven't heard the discussion amongst children and youth as to what should the landing look like.
There you go.
As an example.
That's one example.
As a perfect example, as we think about recreating downtown, where are children? What's their voice? What would they like to see happen? And in fact, if we hear their voice, what they want is going to bring families into the downtown area. Hearing Alexis and her colleagues and friends as to what it would mean to have a downtown that was inviting for them to participate in our community and to be engaged in our community.
This is all such an important discussion. So I thank you all so much for sharing it with us. Dr. Jeff Goldhagen of UF Health, Gary Bevel, Children's Ombudsperson with the Children's Home Society, and Ed White Sr., Alexis Evans, as UNICEF kicks off a discussion in this city, the first American city where they're doing this, bringing their child-friendly Cities Initiative to the First Coast. Thanks to all three of you for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, this weekend's top five with The Spectator, her picks. But up next, commemorating Holocaust Remembrance Day here in Jacksonville. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at hightideburrito.com.
World Affairs Council and the River Club, partnering to strengthen understanding of an increasingly complex, connected, and competitive business world. Coming May 21st, Mark Zandes, Chief Economist of Moody's Analytics, information, worldaffairsconciljax.org.
Join WJCT and PNC Grow Up Great to celebrate Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the WJCT studios. Meet Daniel Tiger, Katarina Kitty Cat, and their friends. Tour TIAA Bank Field, meet community helpers, face painters, enjoy local food trucks, arts and crafts, and so much more. Reserve your spot today for this free, family-friendly community event by visiting wjct.org. Start something good in your neighborhood.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to the Electro Lounge, where new jazz, chill out, and dub are played Monday through Saturday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, a community-wide Holocaust Memorial commemoration takes place tonight in Jacksonville. This is happening as a rising tide of anti-Semitism is sparking disturbing and deadly incidents around the nation, including incidents that have happened here at home. There's much to discuss here, and we're pleased to welcome Rabbi Yaakov Fish from the Synagogue Etz Chaim. They'll be hosting the observance tonight. Rabbi, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And how concerned are you about anti-Semitism in this country as we're seeing spikes in incidents of hate groups and deadly shootings at Jewish synagogues in America? Give us a call as we discuss this. It's 549-2937. And so your synagogue is hosting this year's Yom HaShoah Holocaust Memorial. This is also being observed in Israel. It's so important to bear witness and tell these stories. And you'll even have some survivors from the Holocaust on hand this evening. Is that right?
Yes, we will.
What will be happening?
So this day was designated years ago by the Israeli government because this was the day that the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was put to an end. And the Israeli government actually had an official commemoration last night. And our ceremony is going on throughout the world. And tonight we will be having a community-wide gathering, and we will be having survivors come forward with their families to light some candles and gather as a community to mark the evening.
That's important to make sure that younger people especially hear from survivors, because it's really alarming to see that younger Americans increasingly don't know the history of the Holocaust. At the same time, there have been two horrifying incidents recently. Earlier this year, a deadly shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue, and just the other day, another deadly shooting at a synagogue in California. These were both white nationalist gunmen who were subscribing to anti-Semitic rhetoric and hate literature, coming on the heels of, you know, racists and neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia with tiki torches and chanting slogans like Jews will not replace us. You know, this climate in this country right now, and we're also seeing these incidents around the world. Unfortunately, it's not surprising because anti-Semitism, as you look historically, pops up again and again. But over the last several years, I think anyone that knows their history has to be concerned, Rabbi. It's very concerning.
Absolutely. One of the disturbing things that we've noticed over looking back at history is that anti-Semitism and hate in general flourishes when there's indifference. And that occurred in Nazi Germany. And we can't allow that to happen again. And there's always pockets of hate and anti-Semitism. And if there's indifference in the face of that, that's just going to allow that to flourish. So there has to be a strong stand against what we're seeing, this anti-Semitism, and it has to be a strong stance against that.
Now, at the same time, we have recently been made aware of incidents at Creekside High School where Jewish students, according to parents who've contacted the school board in St. Johns County, have been subjected to bullying, harassment, hate speech, and worse, other students making the Nazi salute to them, saying Heil Hitler. They've been sent pictures covered with swastikas and anti-Semitic slurs. And so here in our own area, local high school students are experiencing this as well. And we just learned about this. So what are your thoughts about that?
It's a great example that no place is immune to it. And we can't be comfortable and say, here we're living in suburban America, and you know, we have nice manicured lawns, and we're living in suburban Northeast Florida, and you know, we're not immune to it. We can't let our guard down, and we have to double down with education, and we have to double down with education on what it means not to allow this to fester, and you know, we can't allow this to happen in our communities.
Now, as all of this is taking place, the Florida Senate recently, it's still in legislative session, they approved a measure adding discrimination based on religion, including actions motivated by anti-Semitic intent, to the list of what is prohibited in Florida schools. They would add religious discrimination to actions based on race, gender, disability, marital status, or national origin. Those are already banned in Florida schools. This action by lawmakers coming after the attack in Pittsburgh, the attack in California, and also shootings, by the way, at mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, and mass bombings on Easter Sunday in Sri Lanka. It's especially, I would think, something that you reflect on as a rabbi of a local synagogue, when I'm wondering if your parishioners have come to you with worries about whether they're safe at worship. This is something that I know many Americans are scared about.
Of course, this is something that up until last few years ago, people didn't think twice about coming to synagogue or a house of worship. It was considered a safe space. You came and you wanted to connect to God, and that was a safe space. But now people are, you know, coming and feeling anxious, and now we have guards at the door, armed guards, and we're talking to law enforcement all the time, and thinking how we can be safe. So It's definitely a worrying worrying trend, but on the other hand, it's not weakening our resolve to go to synagogue. We're proud Jews and proud Americans, and we want to continue to worship proudly and be patriotic American Jews. So there's this delicate balance over there, but it's definitely a worrying time in that regard.
Yeah, it is, particularly with, I would think that, you know, the white nationalist rhetoric that we're seeing these mass shooters subscribe to, this absurd and false notion that Jewish Americans are somehow behind a nefarious plot to push out white America, as they define it, in favor of a more multicultural America. You know, this is what led to deadly violence in Charlottesville. This kind of hateful thinking is what led to the mass shootings at synagogues. And if we don't stamp it out now and deal with it right now, as we know, this type of thinking and this type of hateful rhetoric can spread and fester and grow and cause danger to many people. And, you know, it's something that I hope everyone is reflecting on. And certainly it's why your program tonight is so important. And by the way, you're hosting Rabbi Jacob Schachter. He serves as the University Professor of Jewish History and Jewish Thought and is a senior scholar at the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. And he's the son of a Jewish chaplain who was part of the first liberating forces of concentration camps, is that right, in 1945?
Yes.
So that he will be a compelling speaker, I'm sure.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to host him this evening. His father, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, as you pointed out, was the first chaplain as part of the U.S. Armed Forces. He actually liberated the concentration camp Buchenwald. And when he walked into Buchenwald in 1945, the survivors that were there were so confused because they saw this military figure dressed in, you know, U.S. Army uniform, and he scram out in Yiddish, Jews, you are free. And they were so confused because they saw these military figures just as these menacing forces. And he's going to speak about his father's experiences tonight as a liberating figure, and we're very much looking forward to his presentation this evening.
It's certain to be an incredible talk, along with Holocaust survivors at tonight's presentation. Let me also make a quick plug for another program coming up later in the month. Our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, is also hosting an event on May 21st at River Garden. This is Through the Lens of History, Anti-Semitism, and the Origins of Hate. That's May 21st. That's coming up later in the month. And then tonight, it is Holocaust Memorial Commemoration at Etz Chaim. They are located on San Jose Boulevard. This begins at 7 p.m., and Rabbi Yakov Fish will be leading this important observance. So, Rabbi, thank you so much for sharing this with us this morning. We so appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and later in the hour, the weekend's best bets from The Spectator. That and more right after this.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at HighTideBurrito.com.
World Affairs Council and the River Club, partnering to strengthen understanding of an increasingly complex, connected, and competitive business world. Coming May 21st, Mark Zandes, Chief Economist of Moody's Analytics. Information, worldaffairsconciljax.org.
On the next Fresh Air, John Bolton on the warpath. We talk with Dexter Filkin, staff writer for The New Yorker, about his article on President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, the hawkish former Fox News commentator. Bolton's aggressive worldview contrasts with Trump's isolationist tendencies. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The crisis in Venezuela has led to critical food and medicine shortages. It's forced millions to flee the country.
It's not a war, but for many it was impossible to do anything because there's no money.
Many have ended up in neighboring Colombia, which now has its first refugee camp. That story and reaction from William Barr's testimony this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
How music is being captured and recorded is changing, and nostalgia isn't the only reason why. Digital recordings aren't going away, but the analog business is back, and it's booming. Finding new ways for old waves? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's being billed as the first Latin American festival in St. Augustine's 450-year history. And it's taking place this Saturday, May 4th, at Francis Field. Festival founder Erica Quintero joins us now with a preview. Hey, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for the invite.
And this is Unidos en la Música, a Latin American festival. Did I get that right?
That's perfect.
Okay,
yes, thank
coming
you.
Up Saturday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., and if you want to have some amazing food, enjoy some great music and more, this is the place to be. What all's on the agenda?
So we have, just as you said, we have a ton of food, a ton of music. We also have some dance workshops that are being taught by some nationally acclaimed instructors. We have a mural competition. So we have three local artists that are going to be painting live murals throughout the day, and folks can vote on what they think is the best one. They have a theme. It's called What is Cultural Unity? What does cultural unity mean to them in 2019? So we'll get their perspective. We'll also have a vendor marketplace. So everyone will be selling authentic arts and crafts and merchandise from Latin America. Mm-hmm. We have a soccer clinic. We have shrimp, scampi from Jumbo Shrimp that's going to be with us. A soccer academy that's going to be teaching soccer. A ton of things.
And this is the first of its kind in St. Augustine, which is surprising given that the Spanish heritage in St. Augustine is so strong.
That's right. You know, we thought this project up about 9 months ago as a group of friends who sat down at a cafe, and we just thought, you know, what hasn't been done here in St. Augustine, and what can we do to kind of leave our mark, leave a legacy? You know, I just had a baby a year ago, and we, you know, we looked at him when he was born, and we wanted him to, you know, kind of be born into a world of unity and inclusion and diversity and education. So, you know, if the world wasn't going to give that to him, then we were going to create it for him. And that's what we wanted to do.
That's wonderful. Now, you're going to have Grammy-nominated performers from Latin America performing on the main stage. So this is going to be an incredible music experience, and people can learn how to dance the salsa. It's going to be a full immersion, which sounds really exciting for
that's
this first weekend in May.
Yes.
Okay, anything else people need to know? This is Saturday, May 4th, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., kids under 12 get in free, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's $5 general admission. We still have VIP tickets available at $50. In the VIP spot, you'll have a tent and chairs and access to certain artists and hors d'oeuvres and a private bar. So it's a great experience. And yes, it'll be Celso Piña, LPT Salsa Group will be there also, and okay. Baba Caiman.
All right, come on out Saturday to the Latin American Festival in St. Augustine at Francis Field. Erica Quintero Have fun.
Thank you very much.
Again, that's Saturday. Finally, this hour, lots of ideas for this first weekend in May.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, from Cinco de Mayo to celebrating the Kentucky Derby and more, Carrie Speckman, a.k.a. The Spectator, has her top five.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's Cinco de Mayo this weekend, too.
It is. Funny you should say Cinco de Mayo, because...
Number five.
There we go. Number five. Cinco, which means five.
That's
in Spanish.
Right, the 5th of
de
May.
De Mayo is under the Fuller Warren Bridge where Ram is. It's noon to 10. They're going to have all kinds of food trucks and adult beverages. They have live music. It's free and pet and kid friendly.
Yeah, come on out to that. Number four.
I'm going
to be at this. The Root Ball.
I heard you're judging the Bodacious Hat Contest.
I am.
It is an annual event that benefits Greenscape and the Late Bloomers Garden Club. And if you can't go to the Kentucky Derby, this is probably the closest you're going
to
get
in
town.
They're
going to have the hats. They're going to have bourbon tastings, mint juleps. Firewater Tent Revival will be playing.
Yeah.
And the space is gorgeous, I'm told.
It is. It's at Bowing Oaks Plantation. Come on out to the Root Ball this weekend. Okay, number three.
Drinks. Small Mouth Sounds, a production by Five and Dime Theater Company, is an acclaimed new comedy from Drama Desk award-winning playwright Betsy Wall.
That is downtown, by the way, the Five and Dime.
Yes.
That's a great pick.
And this is its last weekend.
And we're getting close to the end. Let's quickly say number two.
Welcome to Rockville.
Is Welcome to Rockville at Metropolitan Park. Everyone knows about this music festival.
Friday, December.
And very, very important, number one,
Purple Rain, a Prince tribute
what
show.
What could be better than a Prince tribute
Except
show?
Except Prince himself.
Except Prince himself.
But yes, they are, I think they're the only tribute band that has been approved by the estate of Prince.
Okay, now, this is important, everyone. We have a ticket giveaway Carrie has for Purple Rain, the Prince tribute show, which is Friday at the Times Union Center.
That is
we
correct.
We have a pair of tickets.
Two tickets, yes.
We have two tickets. Email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org if you want a pair of tickets to Purple Rain, a tribute to Prince, and we will pick the winner at random. So,
of course.
Who doesn't want them some Prince?
I'm going. I'll be there.
I know you will.
Of course I will.
That's Friday night. Go to thespectator.com for her top five list and some other ideas for your weekend. Here's a little bit of Prince just for you, Spectator. We were thinking about you. All right, we'll be back tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Thursday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.